Hi, Lilia.
Hello.
Before we talk about your mystery novel, I have another type of mystery I'd like your help with. You live in Reykjavik, Iceland, and I don't know about the rest of the world, but here in the States, we're taught that beautiful Iceland got its name from Vikings to discourage others from going there. In addition, Greenland was named to make it sound more attractive to keep people away from Iceland. So once and for all, from a native, because I question this, is this a true story?
I only hear this explanation from Americans, but of course it is mysterious that Iceland is so green and beautiful and Greenland is just ice. But there is maybe an explanation, because in the Viking Age, Iceland was much more icy. And then came a much warmer period where everything melted. The ice cap melted. Greenland has kept its ice cap. So, but I don't know. It's I think it's probably a very good marketing by the Vikings, I should say. It's like, you know, come to Greenland and there you will die from cold. So they won't bother us in beautiful Iceland, where it's full of walrus and whales and other good stuff that the Vikings were after.
I will tell you, I'm familiar with how we teach geography in this country, and I can assure you it's probably wrong if the rest of the world isn't saying it. But it is fun. But hold on, and we'll start talking about your mystery.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
Hi, I'm Brad, and welcome to Queer Writers of Crime. Iceland has become the place to find outstanding crime thriller authors, and my guest today is one of them, Lilja Sigurðardóttir. I hope I got that right. I feel a matter of respect. I have to say your name at least once. Did I get it right?
Almost, yeah. It was a very, very good attempt.
You say it once for me.
Lilja Sigurðardóttir.
Okay, that was much different than I said it. You did it very well.
Yeah, but the thing in Iceland is it's a very small society and we are very much on a first name basis. So we very rarely use those long, complicated surnames, which are in fact not surnames, but patronyms or matronyms. So it's a very, very old way of naming people. So I think we are the only nation left that keeps this in this, the only Nordic nation left that keeps it actually as a patronymic system. So just call me Lilja, that's fine.
I am all for that. So welcome, Lilja.
Thank you.
Now joining us today is also Lori Egan, and in addition to giving book recommendations here each month, she is an author too. Hi, Lori.
Hi there, it's Brad and Lilja.
Hi.
And if you're wondering why Lori is co-hosting with me today, well, that's easy. She's a big fan of Lilja, and I won't say she begged to join me, but it was pretty close.
Well, what I did was I did a review of Snare, which is Lilja's first book of her first trilogy. So then I've read four more after that. So I've read five books altogether.
Yeah, needless to say, you have a fan.
That's always very excellent to know. Thank you, Lori, for reading my books.
Well, my pleasure.
For those unfamiliar with Lilja, she's written nine novels, five of which have been translated to English. And in just about a month, her novel Red as Blood will be added to that translation list. And it is available as we speak on pre-order right now. So go ahead and order. Lilja would be happy. And in addition to being an award-winning author, she is also an award-winning playwright and scriptwriter. And Lilja, what is it about Iceland's soil that so many crime writers seem to be popping up throughout your land?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question, because in Iceland, actually, we have quite a very low crime rate, I would say. At least we have very few murders. We have on average 1.5 murders a year, I think. Although with COVID, that went up slightly. But I think we could say three murders a year is the maximum for us usually. But we have many crime writers, so we kill much more people in books than we do in real life, which I think is good.
That's a good way to take it out.
Yeah, Yeah. But of course, I mean, when you speak of the Nordic countries, people tend to think of them as these perfect models of society. But of course, there is an underbelly to every society. And in Iceland, we have very high rates of economic crime for some reason. Mm. I think it's because we are still just these robbing Vikings that go over the world and steal people's money. But we don't kill them anymore, which is good. And then we have, unfortunately, very high rates of sexual violence, which is quite strange when you think of it that Iceland has one of the best women's rights in the world. It's one of the best places to be a woman, actually, regarding legal situation, equality in pay and opportunities and so on. But the sexual violence seems to be like a backlash somehow to that. And it's something that, you know, Icelanders are in quite an important discussion on how to tackle this. So we have crime here, even if it's not murder. So I write quite a lot about, for example, economic crime in my books. There's always a thread of that because I have plenty of material for that. But of course, there is, like in my newest series, Red as Blood is coming next month, and Cold as Hell is out. It's the first in the series. And there we have a missing persons case. And that actually, we have a big missing persons list in Iceland. So because our nature is very rugged and a lot of people go missing here every year. So that is inspiration for a crime writer. I mean, what happened to the missing people? Maybe some of them were killed. Hmm.
I lived in Las Vegas and we had a high missing persons rate, but that was because they were normally buried in the desert. But
yes,
it's easy to get rid of a body in Las Vegas or in Nevada.
Yeah, I've seen that in the films.
There's truth to it. So you and I mentioned Red Blood is coming out soon. Anybody can go to your blurb online and read what it is, but that's not enough for us. Obviously, you don't want to give too much away. We don't want to spoil it for anybody, but dig a little deeper than the blurb and tell us what the story is.
Well, I got the idea for the story from a Norwegian case. It's called the Hagen case, where Anne Elisabeth Hagen disappeared from her home one day and nobody knows what happened to her. But on the kitchen table was a ransom note and her husband was told to pay obscene amounts of money for her release. And they were a wealthy couple, so this was quite realistic, but there's been no conclusion in the case whatsoever. The supposed kidnappers never contacted them again and so on. So I got the idea for the book there. It's not based on this case, just to be clear, but the case was an inspiration for it. So the book is about a man called Flossi, who is a businessman, wealthy businessman, and he comes home one day and his wife has disappeared and there is a ransom note on the kitchen table. So my main character, Aurora, is called in for help, and there come in the characters of the police, who are Daniel, and his assistant Helena, who, for all our enjoyment, is a very promiscuous lesbian. So we can all be happy with that, because we need more promiscuous lesbians in crime fiction, in my opinion.
We need more promiscuous people in general.
Yes, I agree.
I have a couple of questions for you. One, I was curious because I understand that you were born in Iceland, but that you were raised in several countries, Mexico, Sweden, Spain. Were your parents travelers or were they from different countries? Is this book reflective of your own experience in terms of having two different Aurora? Is half Icelandic and half Scottish, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, you're right about that. I always wanted to write a book that would explore Iceland as an outsider, you know. And this character of mine, Aurora, she comes back to a land that was her homeland and she has a different view on it now after having lived elsewhere for a long time. So you are right about that. My own upbringing was quite unusual. My parents were, you could say, hippies in a way. So they just packed their kids in the backpack and off they went with four kids. But my dad was actually is a historian and he's a specialist in Christopher Columbus. So when he was doing research, we moved to places that were near museums where he could get access to manuscripts, basically. So Mexico, Sevilla in Spain, where the Museo de las Indias is, and then, you know, different places when he was on research leave. I spent some time in the US and in Sweden and many places. But it's always this coming back to Iceland. And Iceland is such a small society that it changes quite fast. So when you leave and you come back 2 years later, there is a new trend and people are doing things differently. And it's very strange. And then some of the customs are so old and they never change. So yeah, it's a special feeling going away and coming back. And I wanted to kind of explore that in these books, in this series. With my character, Aurora.
You had an interesting line in Red as Blood. He said, quote, "This was a country of which she had never been all that fond, but which attracted her like a magnet." When I read that, I thought, well, is that the author speaking here or the character?
Iceland is a lovely country. It's quite magical. It's a country that's creative itself. I mean, it's erupting just a few kilometers away from my house. There is a live volcano. I can see the glow in the night. So there is a lot of like this creative, magical energy. The nature is very strong. The society is quite strong and the family ties are very deep. For example, for winters, it's very claustrophobic. It's a very small society, and I think queer people especially experience that quite a lot. And the darkness and the cold and so on. So I try to leave the country as much as I can during winter and spend the summers here.
One of the things that I noticed in your first trilogy and these two books is that, you know, you've got a lot of financial crimes. You know, your protagonist is essentially, that's her specialty. You know, and I know some authors like Scott Turow, for example, do legal suspense titles. But I was wondering if this is going to be a theme all the way through your books, do you think? Are you going to include the financial crimes, money laundering, and...
Yes, well, this series that we are talking about here that starts with Cold as Hell and continues with Red as Blood, I actually just handed in to my publisher in Iceland the fourth one in this series, and they are going to be 5 in total. And as the main character, Aurora, is a financial investigator, she's like a money bloodhound, she looks for hidden money, there will be some financial crime in all of them. Although I'm not... so passionately interested in it that will not be the main theme of the books, although it's always there on the side.
Do you have any background? Because I couldn't find any background of yours in economics or business or just research or...
Yes, research, because Iceland had a very strong, what shall I say, or very dramatic event in October 2008 when the country basically went bankrupt. All our banks collapsed on the same day. It turned out that they had been engaging in illegal and unethical stuff, and they had grown to multiple size of the country's economy. So Iceland kind of just bankrupted, and a lot of people lost their homes and people lost all their savings and so on, like happens in a crash when all the banks go under. And this experience is the situation like my trilogy Snare, Trap and Cage starts with, where people find themselves doing things that they wouldn't have expected the year before, you know, just to survive. And while I was writing that book, I started reading up on the crash and the causes and the court cases and so on, and had some help from a financial investigator. And I've been quite interested in that. It's always on the side, kind of, because it's interesting. And these financial crimes can be very, very big and very, very damaging, but... they're not very sexy to write about. It's mostly like transactions in a computer. So it's not very fun to read about, is it?
Actually, I'll tell you, when she did the book recommendation, she brought up that it sounds like it would be really dry, but it was not.
Yeah.
She did emphasize that.
That's good. I'm glad to hear it, yeah.
No, something I don't know much about. So I thought you really did a masterful job of explaining money laundering and how this worked and the international web of various shell companies that are involved. And, you know, this seems to be a theme all the way through, at least the first five books that I've read.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to hear it.
I'm also curious, you've got, you know, a lesbian character, as you said, Red as Blood, and in Sonia and Agla in your first trilogy are mentioned, or lesbians were a little more prominent. I'm curious about your decision to take a sort of heterosexual spin with the two main protagonists in the first two books of the second series. Did you do this for what reason? Just because that seemed to be the story that needed to be written, or did you?
It's kind of hard to explain it, but always when I starting to write, it always starts with a character for me, and it's always like a character that starts, I wouldn't say haunting me, but it's like a strong idea of a character that kind of builds itself in my head. And then, I mean, I build a lot of characters in my head, and some of them go missing quite quickly, but some of them stay with you. And you know this as a writer yourself, and you have to work with them, you know, do something with them. And when I wrote Snare, I just wrote the book that I would like to read. And my publisher in Iceland is very, you know, liberal regarding gay rights, and they just took the book on and never even mentioned that it was like a lesbian main character. It wasn't an issue for them. And then they started, when my agents started to sell it in other countries, and it became an issue, and they were like, oh, they were so surprised. And that tells a story about where we are in Iceland, which I'm very grateful for, to live in such a country that like really embraces the queer community. So it wasn't really a decision. I just wrote the character that was there, you know, and that continued through three books. Then I wrote this political thriller called Betrayal. There is a strong character there, one of the main characters, who is a lesbian witch and the cleaning lady in the ministry. And then when I started writing Cold as Hell, I just wrote the book and finished it. And after it was in print, I started like, there isn't any queer character in there. But there is, of course. Lady Gugulu, the drag queen, is there.
A wonderful character.
Yes, I like her. She's the main character in the new one that I just handed in. Yeah, we get the backstories, you know, as we go along. But but it's hard to explain. It's, for me, it's very organic, and it wasn't really a decision. It's more like in my life there are queer characters and straight characters, and so I guess the books kind of just represent my world in a way. It wasn't a decision, although I really regretted not having a strong lesbian character in Cold as Hell, but I made up for it in Red as Blood. She comes in like double there.
Well, I completely understand about your situation, because that's the way I write too. You know, sometimes these characters, you sort of channel them. They come in and they have to do their thing.
Yeah. Are you ever tempted to write to market?
It's a difficult question. The market is your readers. So yes, I write for my readers. I try to make the best book I can so that the readers will enjoy it. And the best I can do is to write the book that I would enjoy reading. And I have, actually, because when I was only writing for Icelanders, I could get away with a lot of stuff that I couldn't get away with anymore when I am published now in 17 countries, and most of my readership is international. So I have to keep that in mind when I'm explaining things that are specifically Icelandic. So in that sense, yes, but in the sense that I've tried to write something that could be on trend or something like that, so like the girl in the cupboard or whatever, no, I wouldn't do that, because trends in publishing are very, very tricky. And the interesting thing for me has been to see that people that have been maybe 30 years in publishing, they have no idea what's going to be the next big thing. Nobody knows it. It's like a complete lottery.
If there's a trend, by the time you write it and it goes through the whole publishing process, it could be long over.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's no point. So I think people should, writers should always try to just write a story that is a good story. And of course, you are writing the story for your readers. So of course, you think of readers there. But I know my readers now, and I know what they appreciate, and it's the same things I appreciate as a reader. So I just continue until somebody stops me in this way.
I like your answer.
Thank you.
I have a question. I understand that Palomar Pictures is doing your first trilogy. Yeah. Is that in production yet, or what is the story on that?
Oh, God. I mean, if somebody thinks publishing is crazy, I mean, welcome to the world of TV production. I have a very hard time understanding what's going on. But it's like, I mean, the script writing has started, and the selling has started, and some things have started. There are, you know, directors there and so on, but I don't feel things are moving. It's such a long timeline for TV production that I'm very impatient, and I just try not to think about it. With books, it's better. I mean, you write a book and you can see it in the shelves next year.
Do you think this is going to be a series or a single film?
It's planned as a series. I think 8 episodes from each book, so that would be good.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, having lived in Los Angeles for 20 years, I never worked in the film industry, but I have lots of friends that have. And I will tell you, the delays are going to come from all kinds of different directions for 100 different reasons. It doesn't mean that it won't be done.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
But like you said, you may have to be very, very patient.
Yes, exactly. I just continue writing books and hope for the best. Because I love TV. I would love to see Sonia and Agla, like strong female lesbian characters in the lead in a thriller, like a crime thriller. I would love to see that. Yeah. So I hope it will be done and it will go as planned.
You wrote some episodes for the Netflix series. Is it Katla?
Yes. That's a volcanic thriller, if you could say so, or it's probably not a thriller. It's very dark, moody. Yeah, it's super dark, super Nordic, atmospheric, artistic. It's a beautiful looking show. We are all very proud of it. But it's a slow burner, it is. But it streamed quite well on Netflix. Yeah, it was nice to see, you know, something going that far around the world.
Yeah, I started to watch it, and then I had to stop for a little bit, but I'm going to get back to it. It is beautifully photographed and very atmospheric,
yeah.
Very dark, as you say. Very dark.
Yeah, very, very dark in all senses, yeah.
And talking about beautiful film, Zac Efron had that Netflix series.
Yeah.
Where he traveled around the world, and he went to Iceland, taught the rest of us that Iceland is 100% natural resource for your energy, a sustainable city?
Yes, that's true. Iceland is a hot spot. We have a lot of thermal energy underneath our feet. You know, if you ask an Icelandic child what's underneath your feet, it would say fire, you know. And that's true. So we use that fire, we use the warmth of the ground to heat our houses. So we have just piping hot water coming into our houses, very, very cheap. We have a lot of waterfalls and steam plants that produce electricity. So it's quite clean, nice energy. So we waste it as we want. The thing is that, which I don't agree with, is that energy companies have been selling their contamination quota or their carbon quota to nuclear plants to some coal power, you know, energy plants in Europe, which I think we shouldn't do. I think we should just pollute less than others. So that's a discussion that's going on here. But yeah, it's 100% clean energy that we use here. I drive an electric car that I charge, and it costs very little, which is good now with the gas prices and everything. So yeah, we're very lucky in that way, because house prices are high in Iceland, but the energy is very affordable.
Well, on that show, Zach and Darren try to cook eggs and bake bread on the ground.
Yeah, did they go to the new lava in, probably?
Yes, I think that's where it was.
Yeah, yes. I mean, there is an Icelandic tradition of baking bread in hot ground. We call it boiled bread, and it's a dark rye bread that you put in a metal tin and bury in warm ground, and then you take it up the day after, and it's delicious. Yeah, it's. I mean, Icelanders are quite connected to the nature, and we use the nature quite a lot. We hunt and fish and grow stuff, and people have been so dependent on making their own food and trying to use this nature that's quite harsh. So we eat very odd foods, but mostly fish and sheep, fish and mutton.
When is your third book coming out, White as Snow, do you think?
That is next year. Orenda Books, that does my World English Publishing, publishes one of mine per year. That's the same rate as I do here in Iceland, although I'm two books ahead here. It's probably September next year.
Okay. They seem to be a great publisher. I've been listening to watching Karen Sullivan on Facebook and along with you, of course, and I wish they would open up their submissions.
Yes. I mean, they get a lot of submissions. It's a very good publisher, and I am very proud to be with them. I think it automatically says quality. They have a lot of, maybe you could say, strange books. They take a chance on different things. And they have published a lot of translated fiction, which is quite new for the English market, because if you look at, for example, France or Germany, 40% of their book publishing are translations from other languages, but it's less than 5%, I think, in the English-speaking market, because you have such a big language, it's such a huge market, and you have basically everything in your own language. But I think it's nice to translate, and it can give the readers an insight into different cultures. And so I think it's important, and I'm very happy to be with them. And they distribute to the whole English-speaking world. So it's Canada, Australia, US, UK, and so on.
Well, I'm curious about the translation. Quentin Bates, has he translated all of your novels? I know he did most of them.
Yes. Quentin is a dear friend of mine. He is also a crime writer himself, and he used to live in Iceland for a long, long, long time. So he not only knows the language, he also knows the culture. So things don't seem strange to him, so he has a way of explaining. And then we Orenda does an edit that kind of tries to make the books, or put the books into more international English. So there's like specific English sayings and so on that are taken away, so it doesn't bother, you know, American readers and so on. So it's like it's a tricky thing to do, because English is not English. It's in fact many, many dialects and languages. But translating is very important, because it's, and for us Icelanders is so important, because we are 330,000 speakers. And I love my language, and I love to write in it, and we have to have writers in our language if we want to keep it alive. So it's important that we have writers. But at the same time, it's so important for us to get to the bigger readership so that we can work as writers. You know, I am a full-time writer, and I couldn't do that without the foreign publishing deals, because there I have just much bigger markets. So translators are precious to us, and they are not so many natural English speakers that have learned Icelandic to the level that they can, like, translate the book.
It sounds like you obviously work closely together during the process. In the translation process, is it difficult to ensure the story stays true to as you originally wrote it?
This is very interesting. I am in good contact with some of my translators, and I really like that I can have, like, a discussion on about things and the atmosphere of the book and so on. And of course, since I speak English and read it, I can read over the translation. That's the only language I can really read over it to the level of commenting on it. So I do that. So I work quite closely with Quentin. So, I mean, if there are like misunderstandings or some quirky little things I can correct. It's really, really strange to read your story in another language, because you not recognize the story, but it's not your text, in a strange way. And I maybe read the passage that I was really happy with in Icelandic, and it doesn't sound nice in English. And then I read another passage that I wasn't particularly happy with in Icelandic, and it's awesome in English. It's so strange. It's very hard to explain it. I sometimes wonder how the stories travel, because, for example, some some of the languages my books are coming out are translated from the English translation or from the French translation. So, for example, Arabic, the Arabic translator, we don't have a translator from Icelandic to Arabic. So, Oya Osraf, the wonderful lady who translates into Arabic, she translates from the English. So I don't know how the story, I mean, I have no way of finding out, but it's popular, so that's good. You know, I never thought a trilogy about a lesbian cocaine smuggler would be popular in the Arabic world, but it is. So, good, you know.
I have to warn you, BuzzFeed has a tube series called Tasty.
Uh-huh.
And they have a show on there where they take a recipe and they run it through 10 different translations. And when it's done, the person has to cook it.
Yeah, oh, what a great idea.
It is hysterical. Let's just say
yeah.
They don't always look like what they originally did. But at least yours is only one additional language.
Yeah, yeah. That's hilarious. Yeah, but I mean, I have no illusions about things get lost, things change slightly and so on. But I think I am a strong believer in the story, that the story and the main atmosphere and the characters, they will get through. They will get through to the readers. And if not, I mean, it's something else. It's creative, you know. I got a question from India through my agent about the film rights for Betrayal for my Indian filmmaking company. And I was like, so excited. I would love to see what they would do with the story. I mean, it's probably something very new, you know. So it, same has to go with translations. They probably change a bit from the original intended, but, you know, hopefully good.
I was going to say, it sounds like the translations is a lot like a movie deal. You just kind of have to let it go and accept they're going to do something with your baby.
Yeah, exactly. And babies become independent and they become, you know, their own persons. So mama cannot control them forever, can she? No.
No.
Well, I think one thing that's probably makes it a little easier to translate your work is because you write a very taut book. You don't go off into, you know, long, long paragraphs. Everything you write is very much, it's very lean and it drives the action. So I would imagine translating your work would be easier than perhaps somebody like Val McDermott, who tends to write a lot more stuff.
Yeah.
You know, her style is different. And
absolutely. Yeah. That's true. I mean, she has a great style and I love her books and she is a dear, dear friend of mine and has been like very supportive to me in my career. But we have a completely different style and I like lean books. Icelandic is also a very old, very archaic language and we don't have possibilities for descriptions of some things are kind of limited, but for other things like weather, they are like limitless. And that doesn't really translate into much interest for foreign readers, like 10,000 pages of weather, which would maybe be interesting for an Icelandic. But yes, I like lean books and I like action and I'm very, very interested in creating something that's almost like a narrative rhythm, like a, so there is like a heartbeat almost in the story. That's how I like to drive the story, that you can almost feel the heart beating. So you continue like one more page, and even read faster and faster. Yeah.
And your chapters are very short, too. So they're very propulsive. You know, the whole structure of your book is, your books are so that you just say, well, okay, I'll read one more page tonight. Oh, no, maybe another, then another. So that makes it very, very hard to put down. And it really fits your style well.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm happy to hear it. Yeah.
Yeah, but those short chapters, like, oh, I have time to read one more.
Yeah.
And then you're grabbed.
Yes. This is like, of course, the goal of every crime writer is to steal away people's sleep. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. You want them up all night.
Yes, keep them up.
It's interesting you talked about how gay-friendly Iceland is.
Yeah.
And I know you had the first queer head of state in the world.
Yes, openly. Yes, that's true. Jóhanna Sigurðardóttir was an open lesbian when she became prime minister, right after the economic crash. So she had a very, very, very difficult job to like rebuild everything, all the whole economy of the country. We have full rights as queer people in Iceland. We have all the same rights as heterosexual people, or that is to say lesbians and gay men. Trans rights are somewhat lacking still, but we are working on that. So I think it is a very good country to live in as a queer person. It's very easy to educate the whole nation because we are just 350,000 people, something like that. And if you are on, if you are in interview in a popular radio program or TV program, I mean, a big portion of the country is going to hear it or hear about it and listen to it in replay. So it's quite easy to get information across. So people are quite sensible and they listen and they are usually ready to change their opinion. Like, I mean, when I was young, people were very prejudiced and it was awful to be gay in Iceland 30 years ago. And then the queer organization had just worked hard for a few years and the nation just changed their mind. And now the Pride celebration is the biggest event in Iceland. It's like 80% of the nation comes to cheer us on, which is great.
Wow. When I read that, I thought this is, it was really odd to me because Uruguay in South America, tiny little Uruguay, is also one of the most gay-friendly countries in the world. And I thought,
yeah,
what is it with these small countries being so gay-friendly?
Yes, and also in a small society, it's quite hard to stay, like, nasty. Because, of course, prejudice is not only lack of information, it's also nastiness. I mean, it's just meanness in a way. If you're not ready to change your mind, if you're not ready to listen to reason and show compassion for your fellow human, of course, you're not that nice of a person, are you? That's my opinion. I mean, you're always gonna know someone who is queer. You're always gonna know a friend of a friend, or your friend is going to have someone in their family and so on. So I think every single family now that people are out and proud is going to have someone queer in their family that they know of or in their friend's family. So it's quite hard to be nasty about it, I think. Yeah.
That makes sense.
I'm just really, I'm really pleased to get a chance to hear all these answers and... Yes, no, Lydia, after reading your books, it's always an interesting thing when you know the author a little bit, just from Facebook and whatever, and a few emails we've exchanged.
Thank you so much.
So, Lydia, I'm going to take us on a strange turn here.
Okay.
And I'm going to ask you to be patient with me. As soon as I start going down the path, you'll quickly know where I'm going. In 1997, the Icelandic Phallological Museum opened.
Yes.
Or simply the Penis Museum, and a gentleman named
Sigurður.
Okay. He started the museum and was its curator for over 40 years. And the reason I'm bringing it up is when I was online, I saw your name pop up on IMDb. And I assumed it was a credit for episodes you wrote for the Netflix series, Katla. And instead, your name was listed under a 2012 documentary titled The Final Member, which explained that the museum has penises from nearly every mammal in the world, but one big one was missing, no human penis. So it was about the quest to get a human penis for the collection. And I'm going to give a spoiler alert to the listeners out there. In 2011, they did get one donated. But listeners will tell you, I dig a lot because I love research, and IMDb had your name but didn't say what the involvement was in the film, and curiosity got the best of me, so I watched some of it. And not far into the film, I saw you, and you were explaining before your dad opened the museum, they were a collection in your house. And, oh, I laugh. Do people find it shocking?
Well, yeah, well, the story of the Phallological Museum is that it started as a joke with from my dad and his friends, and now it's one of Iceland's biggest tourist attractions. So my dad has stopped running it, and my brother runs it, because, of course, it's inherited in the male lineage. It's quite an interesting collection. It's like a mix of natural history and humor. It's not pornographic at all. It's a fun place to visit.
Yeah.
And yes, sometimes when I was helping my dad out when I was younger, I mean, I used to tell him, I mean, you can trust me with it. I have absolutely no interest in penises at all. So I was you know, the one to be trusted. But yes, that's his work, and he's a special man. As I told you before, my parents are kind of hippies. They get great creative ideas and they just do whatever comes to mind. And this is one of many, many inventions of my dad, is this museum. When I was growing up, everything in our house was homemade. My dad built the furniture, my mom did the curtains. They painted and decorated the house in like very creative ways. We used to go treasure hunting on beaches and pick up stuff that came up on the beach and make furniture and stuff out of it, and all the things. And the museum is one of these things. And it's quite interesting now, and I recommend people take a look at it if they come to Reykjavik. It's a fun thing, and they have also good coffee. And my brother is a great host now.
And I recommend the documentary because it was really fun to watch.
Fun. Yeah, yes.
Final Member, excellent name. What I thought was funny is that, as you just said, that it was a collection in your home.
Yes.
In the beginning for friends and family to view. And you said it was a normal part of your family life. And I get that growing up surrounded by penises, I guess it would be normal.
Yeah.
But looking back, do you see it from the same perspective, or is it, do you kind of look back and say, well, that was kind of weird?
Not really weird, because when you're a kid, I mean, what's natural to you is just natural to you. And our house was very lively, full of artists and creative people. And I mean, my parents would always rather have porridge for dinner for a month than buy a painting. It's like they were very unusual people, and it's quite difficult for me to explain my childhood. But it resulted in that all my siblings and myself, I think we can say we are creative people. We create our own worlds. I do it through my books. I'm maybe the most traditional, probably, of my siblings. I am married to a very lovely lady, and we have our house by a little lake in Iceland and a second home in Scotland, and live quite traditionally, besides the fact that we are two women. But my siblings are more like traveling all over the world and living in Africa. And my brother is running a penis museum, and, you know, they're just much wilder than I am. I'm the baby of the family. But as you say, I mean, what's normal in your household when you're a kid, it doesn't feel weird after all. I mean, because there was never any negative connotation about it. It was always just a laughing matter. And we also had a big, big collection of insects in formaldehyde, and my mother was catching spiders everywhere and putting them on display. I mean, it's like that didn't become a professional collection, but I mean, I was like showing the kids from school, like, see, here's the tarantula. You know, and this is a sheep penis. Yeah, it was just my childhood.
From the film, when they're dried or dehydrated, they kind of really don't look like penises anyway.
No, that's true. And I think, I mean, what's the funny thing about the penis museum, because people think like it's a male chauvinistic thing, but it actually is quite an interesting deconstruction of the idea of the penis, because the penis is both vilified in our culture, but it's also put on a pedestal, you know, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you look at it, and you look at animal penises and the human penis, and it's on display in a museum with explanations, and you just realize it's an organ. In a way, you can look at it in a feminist way, and you deconstruct the penis, and here it is, just in. And it's not so much glory. It's just an organ like any other. It could be a heart or a hand or whatever on display. And it's really not much more interesting than that. At least not to me.
Okay, well, getting back on track.
We've spent too much, because I'm a lesbian writer. We spent way too much time on penises now for the listeners, haven't we? What do you say, Laurie?
I don't know. I'm not going to touch that one.
I think she's just stunned, you know.
I get that. I understand. You won Play of the Year in 2014, and then you've written the scripts as well. These are different types of writing than a novel. Does writing each of those help you hone the craft with the others?
Yeah, Yes, I think it does. I feel my dialogue improves the more I screenwrite, because when you're writing for screen, you basically only have the dialogue. You have to get everything in there. You cannot write descriptions. You cannot write what the person is thinking. You have to get everything into the dialogue. So the dialogue becomes so important. So that has, improved the writing of my books. I consider myself a very visual writer. I see the stories in my head like a film. And I think I am one of the oldest writers in Iceland that has been influenced by TV. And that is because I spent a lot of my childhood abroad, where we had a lot of TV. Because when I was a child in Iceland, we only had TV after 7 o'clock, not on Thursdays, and not during July. So there was like 3 hours of television per night. You know, you waited for the important shows like the whole week, and, you know, there was nothing else. But then we moved to America and then Mexico, or to the US and then Mexico, and there was TV 24/7, many channels, and I think I was very influenced by that, because these are stories. It's a different way of telling stories. I think you can see it in my writing that my books can, you know, you can almost see them as a TV series or a film, because I myself feel that I am seeing them in my head when I write. And I think it's beneficial to do different types of writing, because it's a rest. I mean, a novel is quite demanding. You have to write a lot of text, and then it's nice mm-hmm. to go to the screenwriting. It's a different type of approach, and I feel like I have rested when I get back to the novel, even if I have been keeping this creative flow going all the time and I never stop writing, you know. I am always writing something. And I don't know, I mean, Laurie, you probably can identify with this as a writer. It's the flow that you have to keep going. I mean, if you stop writing, take a holiday and you come back to it, it takes you a few days to get into rhythm, doesn't it?
I never take a holiday anymore.
It's best never to stop.
I try to go to sleep at night and I turn the light off, and then 5 minutes later I turn the light back on and write some notes, and then I turn the light off and then I write some more notes. And, yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you my trick for that. It's a dictaphone.
I know. I was going to buy one. They were sort of expensive, and I don't have a fancy cell phone.
I had to do it because my wife was like, turn off the light, you know, because I was turning on the light and making notes in my little book when I woke up from a dream or just got an idea late at night. And so the dictaphone, I can whisper into it in the dark.
No, it's a continual process. There's no, and I agree with you. Yeah, I'm also a fine arts photographer, so I have that visual sense too. So I think that really helps with your writing, because you notice details. If you're sort of seeing the work unfold in your mind, I think that really makes for a better book.
Well, it's funny because I got notes from my editor that being visual was actually one of my disadvantages.
Really?
I'll explain why. My novels tend to be very dialogue heavy.
Yeah.
And there was a scene I wrote, and she's like, I don't see where you are. I don't see where they are. They're like floating in space. And I'm like, it's clear as day. You can't see that. And she's like, you can see it in your head. That's why you can't see that it's not on paper. And that made total sense. And now I have to stop and remind myself of that anytime I'm writing. Has that happened to you?
It happens to me in the sense that I write something that makes sense to all Icelanders,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't make sense to the rest of the world. So, like, if you say, for example, because it's such a small country, and we have like this joint knowledge of things, joint knowledge about certain things. And if I, for example, write the Parliament House, I just have to write the Parliament House, and everyone sees it in their head
mm-hmm.
because it's a black chunky house downtown Reykjavik. But if I'm writing, you know, then I get the translators write me back and say, like, you have to describe the Parliament House. It doesn't make sense to a French person or an American person how this house looks like. So this is what you asked me before. This is what has to make sense to the reader. It's like, the big black stone cobblestone. You know, you have to, like, describe it to the reader, even if it's a one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you become so blind on your own work, you have no idea, you know, how it appears to the reader. And that's what editors are for. Thank goodness for editors. I am notorious for strange stuff in my writing because I write very fast. And my editor is the one who keeps me on the ground.
Yeah, and that's why I know myself and other writers, you have to put it aside for a while sometimes because after you've read it over and over again in editing, you don't even see it anymore.
No, that's true.
You're reading what your brain wants you to read. You miss those continuity errors and those sort of things. That, like you said,
you read what's supposed to be on the page, but not
exactly
what really is there. Yeah.
And that's why every editor I know has an editor.
Yes, exactly.
It's critical.
Yeah.
Absolutely critical. It has been wonderful talking with you. It's been a pleasure.
Yes.
Likewise. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, I was so happy to discover you. So I suggested to Brad that I review one of your first books, Snare. And, you know, then we got to talking. I said, I have a feeling she's going to be a charming guest. And
thank you.
You were correct. Yes.
Thank you so much.
You've been very charming.
Thank you. You're very kind.
To remind everyone, it's Lilja. I'm going to let you pronounce your last name again.
Sigurðardóttir.
Her book that is coming out in October, newly translated, is Red as Blood, and it's going to be in about a month. But it is available right now to pre-order, so don't forget to do that. And thank you again.
Thank you.